Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Outdoor Connection. My guest this morning is Dennis Ferraro. He is a conservation biology professor and the state herpetologist. And I believe when we were talking on the air, or talking the other day, I believe this is the first herpetologist I've ever had on the show, Tristan. So, good morning, Dennis. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine.
And how are things back in your neck of the woods?
In Lincoln, it's going to be a hot day today. It's going to be a basking day for most of my colleagues.
A basking day. I like that.
Yeah, we're ectotherms, so we get all our sun, so we have to bask.
Oh, I knew I was going to like you. When did you become interested in reptiles and snakes and lizards and turtles and all that kind of stuff? I have this mental image of you being the kid that could always be found in the creek somewhere.
You're 100% correct. I grew up on the East Coast in Connecticut, and
my condolences.
Yeah, well, I was born at Yale, but so my parents had an acreage, you know, that was in a very heavily wooded area with a creek.
Nice.
And I can remember in the third grade, so I guess that's 8 or 9 years old, one of the first days of school, the teacher asking the class, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, you know, Jane wants to be president, and Johnny wants to be a lawyer, and whatever. And I raised my hand saying I want to be a herpetologist. And I vividly remember the teacher running to a dictionary to look it up.
Really? That's cool. My son, we have a similar story with him. He is now has his PhDs and whatever, but we have a story in the family that he was about 3 years old when he walked into the room one day. His mom and I were sitting there watching TV, and he walks in, blocks the TV, puts his hands on his hips, and in an authoritative posture as a three-year-old can muster, he says, "I believe I'm going to be a scientist when I grow up," and then walked out of the room. And he never deviated from that direction.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yep. So it's pretty much been in me my whole life. You know, there was points where I would, you know, my father was very, you know, supportive. My mother, you know, bringing snakes in the house wasn't the best thing for her. So I would have to sneak them into my bedroom and put snakes in my dresser drawers, which did not go over very well. Because they didn't stay there, and finally they gave in and had a small room in the basement with aquariums and things like that.
That's just awful close-minded of your mom.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, man, I love this. So when did you actually decide? I mean, you were talking about, you know, the teacher running to get the dictionary and figure it out, but when did you really decide that this is going to be my life's work? This is what I'm going to follow through and get a degree in, or multiple degrees in.
Yeah. Well, it's always been towards that way, and also I looked into veterinary medicine on the exotic side, say the zoological side, zoos. So when I was, you know, my junior year in high school or whatever, and I did very well in the sciences and loved the sciences all through high school, was president of the science club, and still pursued these things all through high school. I applied to a number of schools that had veterinary medicine and had a herpetologist. And back then, because it was in the 70s, mid-70s, I wrote a letter to the herpetologist at these schools, asking them, you know, can I also get a master's while I'm pursuing a veterinary degree at their schools? And the first, and I think one of the only ones to write me back, was Marilyn Bachman, who was a new professor at Iowa State University. And so I did my first 2 degrees at Iowa State. I went through and did herpetology with her. And at the same time, I went and I applied for vet school. And during the interview for vet school, I told them what I wanted to do. And remember, this is mid-70s. They pretty much says, You know, you're going to work with large animals if you want to get your vet degree. No one gets their vet degrees in herps. And so I just went on to further do my herpetology and did not do that. Now I have students who, I have three right now, that achieved their master's in herpetology, and they're now in their second and third and fourth year of vet school. And so they're going to come out and then finish up with a PhD and be a DVM PhD in herpetology. Because now with the ZW, or Zoo Exotic Wildlife line in veterinary medicine, is growing exponentially. And I think I do workshops for our second year veterinary medicine students here at UNL. And there's a great interest, you know, I teach them how to do ultrasound on snakes and how to put turtles under anesthesia and how to draw blood on frogs. It's amazing, you know, the numbers of students now that are getting into that. Matter of fact, this last class, UNL only has 26 veterinary medicine DVM students at any one time, any one class. And I would say easily, a third of them were ZW, which is Zoo Exotic Wildlife.
Very good.
And less than a quarter were large animal. So they're of course the primary, probably two thirds were companion pet.
Right.
Tracks.
But right.
Yeah. So it seems like the zoologicals or the wildlife vets are increasing, and the large animal are extremely decreasing.
Had you pursued your into the DVM, the veterinary sciences one, I have this image of you being the only guy that specialized in Komodo dragons.
That would be great. You know, it was fun. I've held Komodo dragons. I've been sitting there with them and everything, and think a lot about them. Yeah, that could be. So at the same time, I was doing my undergraduate. There was a couple of students that were veterinary medicine bound with, you know, taking classes with me. One of those students was Doug Armstrong, who did get his DVM and became the vet for Henry Gorley Zoo and just retired last year. So
very nice.
He went that route. He's into cats, though. Big cats was his big forte. But,
I don't think I ever met him when I was running around Henry Gorley. Had a chance to meet Jim Fowler a few times, and very interesting man.
Yeah.
Anyway, since we were off into the realm of turtles, snakes, and lizards, how many of these various species do we find in Nebraska?
Okay. We have 10 species of lizards, 9 species of turtles, and 29 species of snakes. And we have 13 species of amphibians, if you want to cover the whole herpetofauna.
Yeah.
2 salamanders, and 11 frogs and toads.
Very nice. Quite a diverse, for Nebraska and its topography, that's
yeah,
quite a bit.
Yeah, it's really diverse, and not all of them are one end. The southeast corner is very diversely, so to speak, heavy, and as you get across the state, the diversity changes some. There is some species that are statewide, but because, you know, especially with amphibians, you know, when you figure that the amount of rainfall from Omaha to Scotts Bluff is just as diverse as the amount of rainfall from New York City to Omaha.
You know, right.
our state's rainfall completely changes. So it makes it nice for stable isotopes. So someone finds a turtle in Scotts Bluff, and I think it's a range extension, all I have to do, and I just did this for... is take their fingernails, do stable isotopes, and I say, someone moved this turtle. It belongs over here.
Now, rattlesnakes are always a topic that comes up, particularly in our part of the state.
Yeah.
So how many rattlesnakes are in western Nebraska? How many species?
Species, okay. In western Nebraska, 1. We have 3 species in the entire state. We only have 4 venomous snakes out of the 29, so 24 of our snakes, 24 of our 29 snakes are 100% harmless to us. I mean, teeth power is less than a quarter inch. There's only one bacterium that my students and I have been able to find that transfer from an ectotherm that has a nucleated blood cell to a mammal or bird that, you know, is a homotherm, and that's Salmonella.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get, you know, as far as we know, you can't get rabies, distemper, West Nile, anything like that, COVID from a reptile. But we do have four venomous. Three of those venomous are in the extreme southeast corner of the state. That's the Massasauga rattlesnake, the timber rattlesnake, and the copperhead. They're really low in numbers. I can find any of those at the right time of year, but I know where to look, and I would think between me and the other herpetologists in the state, we have majority of the timber rattlesnakes and Massasaugas tagged with electronic tags. I think we're down to less than 500 individuals in each of those species. And all those species are within, 5 to 6 counties in the southeast corner of the state right now. That's all that's left. Now, if you draw a line from about Kearney, diagonal to Knox County.
Okay.
West and north of that line, so all the way up into South Dakota and the western part of the state, that's where the prairie rattlesnake is found. And that's the one that people can see because its population is declining, but it's not an endangered species in the state. It's not a tier one like the other ones. The other two rattlesnakes are our only two snakes in the state that the Natural Legacy Project for the state says that they're tier one, which is analogous to state endangered. So the prairie, and again, the prairie, because, you know, people think they look different because our eyes are the way we look at color, which is the worst thing to look at. Color is like saying you're a Homo sapien or a human because you're blonde. If you're brunette, you're not.
Yeah.
which we know is not right. So we get different patterns. I've caught a prairie rattlesnake near Mitchell that is completely patternless and cream colored. I've caught one in Hooker County that is, as its name predicts, is really greenish. The scientific name of that prairie rattlesnake is Crotalus viridis, viridis
okay.
meaning green.
Right.
We have no diamondbacks. They don't get close to Nebraska, and they don't travel that far. I have found rattlesnakes. Prairie rattlesnakes, and that's just because it's a mutation that occurs. I don't think it's occurring, that mutation is not occurring as much in Nebraska as it is in other states where they hunt them. And so they hunt and kill the ones that rattle first. So, of course, the ones that are mutated without a rattle
tends to pass on that trait, yeah.
Survive to pass that trait along,
right.
which is a dangerous thing.
Could, yeah.
For us. And speaking about that, I do have to say that 75% of the rattlesnake bites that occur in the nation and also in Nebraska, which we get less than 5 a year, 75% are people going to capture or kill the snake. So the thing is, if you don't want to get bit, leave it alone. There's no snake in Nebraska that'll go after a person. Once you get 10 foot away, you're out of their vision, and they will try to get away and go hide. Now, if you're within 10 foot, they think they're going to be killed, and they'll stand their ground and defend themselves. Okay, so that no snake has territory in Nebraska. There is snakes that have territory, but none of those in Nebraska have territory. And none of them have parental care, so they're not going to care about their young. So, you know,
I've noticed even with the rattlesnakes I've encountered, if you didn't make any more movement toward them, once they've thought that maybe the danger had passed, they'll get out of your way. They'll move on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're fearful for their life, and that's the reason why they rattle. Because the rattle is to tell you, I'm scared, get away from me. And it's, you know, all snakes rattle their tail. It's just that the rattlesnakes have developed an apparatus to make that even louder.
Right.
Because even bull snakes and garter snakes will rattle their tail laterally. And that's one way people call me, there's a rattlesnake on the trail in Omaha. I'm going, and is it rattling its tail back and forth? And I'm going, they go, yeah. And I go, well, that's a bull snake, because a rattlesnake will stick it straight up in the air. Okay, because it doesn't need to hit it against anything. And it'll be dampened if it hits it laterally. So they do it vertically.
So I hear some music in the background. That's my engineer telling me that we got to take a break. So
okay,
we'll do a couple commercials, and then I got a few more questions for you, Dennis, if you'll stay with us.
Great.
We'll be right back after these messages, folks. Stay with us.
Marik von Rennenkampf, State Department analyst and Obama regime appointee at the Defense Department, in an op-ed for The Hill. This guy's calling for Democrats to stop being cowards and to teach Republicans a lesson. If the Republicans dare confirm a Supreme Court justice for the vacancy caused by RBG's passing, von Rennenkampf says that the Democrats must take off the gloves and use fear-mongering to whip up their base. He says the Democrats must immediately impeach Trump again, this time on the pretext that Trump supposedly begged the Chi-Com president to help with his re-election. The Democrats have to hold hearings in his zone with anti-Trump witnesses, he says. The Democrats should also grant Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. statehood so they can seize control of the U.S. Senate by installing four new Democrat senators in perpetuity. The Democrats should also give big blue states like California more political power than states like Wyoming, which contribute nothing to our economy, he says. And to top it off, the Democrats should stack the Supreme Court by adding seats. Now think about this. Marik von Rennenkampf is a mainstream Democrat. He was a high-level Obama regime appointee. Perfect example of tyrants in waiting running the deep state, which Democrats claim doesn't exist, while this guy is out proving it right here and now.
In January of 2017, I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia.
And within 24 hours of that diagnosis, we found ourselves here in Memphis at St. Jude. They knew what they were doing. They knew how they were going to treat her. They laid out this elaborate plan.
We didn't know what the future was, or if there even was a future. But with St. Jude, there was.
Not that long ago, the survival rate was 4%. 4%. But through the work and research that St. Jude does, that's now 94%. And you know how that got done? It's through donations. By people getting behind this mission that no child dies in the dawn of life.
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, finding cures.
Here's your forecast on News Talk 1240 AM and 106.1 FM. We'll see mostly sunny skies here for today with a high into the mid-80s. Winds out of the southwest around 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear skies and a low near 47. By Saturday, mostly sunny, breezy, high 90 degrees. Then by Sunday, a slight chance for some rain showers, blend of clouds and sunshine develops with a high around 66. Weather is brought to you by Northlet Airport with daily jet service to Denver and beyond. Book at united.com.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Dennis Ferraro this morning, professor at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln in conservation biology and our state herpetologist. When we were left, we were talking a little bit about some of the snakes in Nebraska, and one of the questions I get occasionally is, at this time of year, what are snakes doing and how do they prepare for winter?
Okay, well, the biggest thing they do to prepare for winter is to stop feeding. Being an ectotherm, if you have anything in your stomach, when it gets cold, it'll putrate and kill you over the winter. So in the next week or two, they will stop feeding and try to bask as much as possible, which means lay out in the sun to digest that food bolus. And then they'll start migrating, and probably after we get a couple of frost nights, towards a place where they're going to brumnate. And brumnate is hibernation for a reptile. We use a different word because it's a different type of torpor. But their body just gets real, really slow, and their heartbeat goes really down. And they get to a place where it doesn't freeze, and they huddle in. And lots of times, there's only one place in an area, and I've been in places where there's probably five or six species and literally dozens of snakes together, and they're fine hibernating together, wrapped up together. That brings another thing, that bull snakes don't harm rattlesnakes. They outcompete them. So sometimes if a bull snake goes to an area, the rattlesnakes go, oh, there goes the neighborhood. We have to leave. This guy eats too much. But I find them hibernating together and living together. They don't mate. They can't. They have different chromosome numbers. So there's no way two species in Nebraska can ever have young because their chromosome, they're actually completely different species. But there's some, like we were talking about the prairie rattlesnake. It has a, and I've caught over 2,000 in the state of Nebraska, and I have 612 right now electronic tags, primarily in Cherry, Hooker, and Thomas, but I have them all over the state. And I found they don't usually move more than a mile, mile and a half from where they hibernate it, and then now they're dispersing back to that hibernation point. Now, since they're viviparous, which means having live young, the females wait till they get back to the hibernation point. So that's usually around this week and the next 3 weeks to give birth. So I'll be out in the sand hills and across western Nebraska, Keith, and Lincoln County too, watching and catching these as they're being born. I usually find and measure about 100 babies within 24 hours after birth. The way I know that is that 48 hours after birth, they get their button on their tail because that's their first shed.
Okay.
And again, the segment on the rattle is every time they shed, has nothing to do with age. You know, they'll get three rattles in the first year, and then maybe five the second year, and then it'll slow down to one or two a year. But
another question I hear occasionally from somebody when the topic of particularly snakes has come up, they said, "What good are snakes? Why don't you kill them?"
Well, two things. I have a T-shirt that says, "The more people I meet, the more I like rattlesnakes." I've never met a rattlesnake. I never met a rattlesnake I didn't like. I can't say the same for people. The other thing is they're extremely well. If you go by Aldo Leopold, everything has value, or it wouldn't be here.
Okay? Right.
His statement, his quote in Round River is, "The height of ignorance is the man, meaning man or woman, that says of any plant or animal, what good is it? Because if it's here, it's part of the system. It has value." Just because we can't figure out that value because it's so complex doesn't mean it doesn't have it. So all biodiversity is extremely important. And we found out, you take out one insect, you take out one plant, the whole ecosystem starts to shatter and integrity falls. And you don't know which block is going to cause a fall to us. You know, and I just made my students read this big long thing that came out by a bunch of scientists. They're showing how not keeping all the biodiversity is causing, especially mammals, these diseases and viruses to jump. And so the more we constrain and lower biodiversity, allow animals to go extinct, the more intense pandemics we're going to have. I mean, the data indicating that is just a lot of good data. Let's put it that way.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's some great stuff. Just it's coming out of universities all over the world.
We've got about 5 minutes left in the show, but I definitely wanted to touch on if a young person is interested in science, wants to get it involved in it more, what path should they follow, and where would they go for more information?
Well, I have my website, where you can follow my lab, plus it's a field guide to all the animal, all the herps of the state, and you can load it right on your phone, and then if you can identify something, you take a picture of it, hit Ask the Expert, it ends up on my phone. And that's herpneb.unl.edu. I'll spell that. H-E-R-P as in Paul, N as in Nancy, E-B as in boy, dot U-N-L as in University of Nebraska Lincoln, dot E-D-U.
Very good. And
then from there, do well in science, do well in math. Math is in everything. Okay? And then you can get, even if you're in junior high school, middle school, if you want to come to the university and get a visit, you know, if Scott Frost can recruit early, I can recruit early, too.
Very good.
Okay?
I ruined one of my son's dreams, I think, by doing kind of a reverse of that. He, at the time, he thought he wanted to be a paleontologist. Of course, he was growing up right when Jurassic Park and all that was big. So I tracked down Dr. Robert Bakker.
Oh,
and
yeah, I've met him. I know
he's a different guy.
He's a character. Yeah.
And they had a big dig going up near Thermopolis, Wyoming at the time, a big T-Rex they had found. So I asked him, I told him, I said, I got a son, he's 12 years old, he wants to be a paleontologist. Is there any way he can come hang out with your dig and some of your grad students? He said, sure. So left Isaac there for about a day digging around in the rocks, and we got back, and I said, well, what'd you think, bud? And he it was more or less, well, I'm going to find another career. Didn't like that one, but you got to give it, got to have the experience.
Yeah, definitely. And so one of my other hats, real quickly, is that I started 12 years ago a thing called the Nebraska Master Naturalist Program.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, and I've, I think over the years, have obtained close to $1 million to run this program through grants. And I just wrote a grant to increase it to what's called Nebraska Master Naturalist Junior.
Very
so
nice.
Teaching teachers, and if this goes through, this grant for 21 to 23, we'll be able to bring on, have programs that almost, we want to have them eventually at most of the schools in the state. So if that, so to speak, second part of my dream comes true, there'll be places where students can be citizen scientists, you know, counting frogs and counting baby garter snakes and things like that, that would get them involved and enthused and give us data.
Very good. Cornell University has a great program like that with birds. Why not have one for reptiles?
Right.
Go
yep.
for it. Dennis, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on the show this morning. We're out of time, but I'll almost guarantee I'll have you back sometime.
Sounds great. I'll be back.
All right. Thanks again. And folks, okay. That's it for this week. We'll see you next time on another edition of the Outdoor Connection.